Welcome to Exploring the Marketplace, a podcast all about how faith impacts our guests' careers and lives. I'm Sean Bowles, here with my co-host.
And I'm Bob Haston, and we're here to bring you unfiltered, powerful conversations with industry leaders, entrepreneurs, and culture shapers who are living out their faith in extraordinary ways. From billion-dollar boardrooms to creative industries, we reveal how God is moving through everyday, ordinary people just like you, and this podcast will give you courage, which is our goal.
Yeah, these are the stories you don't get to hear on Sundays. Plus, we get to dive deep in the latest trends in business, finance, entertainment, and politics, giving you real insight from a kingdom and biblical perspective.
This is where faith meets influence. This is Exploring the Marketplace.
Well, here we go, Sean. This is going to be a great episode. Talk to me. Let us know what we're doing.
Well, we got a couple of really good things coming up. The first one is a real talk with you and I, and we're going to go after identity distortion, which may not be a term people are familiar with, but it's basically the trap of comparison or imposter syndrome, or even spiritual pressure that leads people to build their own version of their career and company that was never God's design. And we're seeing a lot of people we're trying to break out of, like, wow, I built this thing for 15 years. I don't like it, although I'm successful or mediocrely successful. I want something new. And it's not necessarily that they want a new career, but people all over the place are saying, I want something new or different. I think it's a cry for help to say, I want God's. I want what God has for me in my career. That's my opinion.
Yeah, you mentioned the imposter syndrome, and we've talked a lot about that. But I think, you know, if we're not sure of our identity in Christ, and we're trying to compete with someone else, like someone said, you need to do this, and now you're doing it, like you said, for 15 years, and you finally say, why am I doing this? I think these questions are hard, and it's not sustainable to continue unless you're secure in your identity and what you're doing.
Yeah, we got to talk all about that, because identity is one of the biggest keys that I think has been trumpeted by churches all across the world over the last 10, 15 years. It's a word that is no longer unfamiliar, and it's a key to all this that we're talking about. Well, then we're going to be joined by an incredible guest, Dr. John G. West, who just released a thought-provoking new book. I've never even thought of this before, Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. Yeah. It's a bold take on how Christians have become captives to cultural approval rather than kingdom truth, which is just wild.
It's pretty wild. So stick with us. This is going to be an interesting conversation, and our guest is going to be fascinating right after this message.
Our sponsor today is Birch Gold, and Birch Gold is going to help you find a little known loophole in the IRS to protect your retirement, your IRA, your 401k with precious metals. And this is an incredible company. They have amazing consumer reviews. You can look them up. They're one of the top, if not the top, in their industry. And they're sponsoring us and giving you a free information guide by going to birchgold.com/Sean Bowles. Bowles is spelled B-O-L-Z. And when you go there, you're going to talk to their experts, whether you get the guide or talk to somebody. They are so informative, and they're going to help you to go on the journey to stabilize your financial future. And we know that gold has been a standard for thousands of years, and it is today still. You don't want to miss out on your opportunity to do something for your financial future and your children's future. Go there today. Well, Bob, for our real talk today, one of the biggest challenges we've seen in business and leadership is identity and people trying to be something they were never called to be. And maybe it's comparison, maybe it's fear, maybe it's just the pressure to perform. But whatever it is, it leads people to force their business, their brand, or even their personal leadership into a mold that it doesn't just actually fit in. And it's one of the leading causes of like what secular world calls midlife crisis, when people all of a sudden realize the life I've built doesn't fit me and it was never what God intended for me. They may not have that articulation, but it happens all the time.
Yeah, Sean, I've seen this a lot. I remember I talk to young people a lot, and I remember this person after person saying, like, I'm a failure. I'm 25 years old and I'm not a millionaire.
Yeah.
And I started asking the question, like, well, who else do you know that is a millionaire at 25? And the answer was everyone. And, you know, actually the average age of a millionaire is 58 years old.
I know, exactly.
But what happened is social media, and I wasn't on social media, and I didn't know what they were talking about, this whole comparison thing. And so, you know, you're just talking about midlife crisis, but it's starting so young because of the influence of social media and trends. And But can we stop and pivot and do what God's calling us to is the question. And how do we stop comparing ourselves with something that's actually not real?
Well, I heard somebody, a minister one time, she said that if you have comparison as part of your operation system, it means you're living out a double calling in a wrong way because you have a counterfeit calling and a real calling. Because you'll serve that comparison over and over and over. And I love, like, the social media thing is a great example. I have a couple of accounts I follow, and they have millions of followers, and they say, hey, I just had a video go viral. We had 20 million views. Guess how much money I made on TikTok? $700. I'm not a millionaire. And they were just like, they're just saying, like, you can become successful off of this, but it's a grind. It's really hard. But people present themselves, especially if they're like a travel Instagrammer or whatever, they present themselves in all these luxurious places. But it's not true. And so a lot of times we start to chase after this thing out of a spirit of comparison that's not real. And we have to be asking ourselves a question is like, what am I called to be? And it's not a repeat or a carbon copy of something else that's out there. And a lot of people are looking for examples of success that don't really exist.
You know, you have said this over and over again, is you say people post their highlight reels. And part of this comparison is, we're living a normal life, and it's just not a highlight reel, you know, 24/7. We have normal lives.
Yeah.
And most people don't post about when they're sick in bed or or a pile of bills that they can't pay. They don't post about that. And so it's this comparison that is just, it's not real. It's not based.
Yeah, this person never gets sick. They don't ever struggle. They don't ever have problems. Mm-hmm. And it's not even true. It's like that comes in the imposter syndrome too, because they feel like with the imposter syndrome, you feel like you have to act more confident or more capable or more aggressive than you really are. And it's basically a performance-driven identity. It's not based on how you can have long-term fruit. It's based on how you think you should act and how you think everybody wants you to act. And it's not authentic. It's not authentic at all.
It's not authentic at all. And I've referenced this before, but in the Harvard Business Review many years ago, they wrote an article about the 10 things that CEOs are the most afraid of. And one of them is the imposter syndrome. Now, they interviewed the top, I think, 100 CEOs in the world by sales volume. And so you have to think, those are the best businessmen and women in the world. And they're talking about they feel the imposter syndrome. So if the best business people in the world are feeling it, like,
yeah,
it's, why wouldn't everyone else feel it? And it's something that you put a name on, and in comparison, like you were talking about earlier, is there. And I think, you know, we have to recognize that our identity is we're loved sons and daughters of God.
Absolutely. I think that the whole thing of this theme is like, if you have your identity rooted and grounded in what God's going to do for you, not based on your performance, not based on where you can lead yourself on your skills and your talents and your education and your, you know, geopolitical background, your social economic background, but you could look at it and go, I want to go where you want to go, God. I'm going to do what you want to do. And thank you for all these things that I might have a leg up in because of how I was born or what family I was born into, if that's a thing for you, or maybe you had family that sent you to college, or maybe you had family who or friends who helped you in some way. But ultimately, you're looking for a man centered result. And I think that that's what we have as a protection of our identity as a Christian, is that we're not looking for to be man or self-made. We're looking to be God made. And that to me pulls you out of a lot of these traps, because you start to compare yourself and go, I need to compare myself against God's desire for me in heaven, not against what I'm seeing on earth. And that's so different.
The cool thing about us as believers and what Jesus gives us the ability to do is to turn and or realign. And so
yes,
if you've been in a system or pretending or an imposter, or if you've been comparing, all you have to do is say, like, I don't want to do that anymore, Lord. I want to turn from it. And I want to ask you, like, what do you have for me? Where do you want me to go? How can I get there? Help me. And he does. I mean, he hung on the cross for us. And so I think it's a beautiful thing, like this topic that you've brought up, because we have the ability today, this very hour, to realign ourselves.
And the realignment isn't hard. It's just coming back into faith. And I guess the thing that's easy to fall out of faith in your career or in your decisions, even if you say the right things and you pray and you do the right things, it's easy to actually in your heart to not center yourself and go, I want your result, God. I want your plan. I want your will. And that's why, you know, like I hate when I get brought into someone's life in the brokenness of a 30-year career when they don't like it anymore and they don't like where they're at, because there's some place in their life that they disconnected early on from what God really wanted them to do versus someone like you, who's like, you know, when I came into your life, you were already decades into your career and you've walked with God the whole time. And you were fine. I mean, some people, like, I've heard it when some people will be like, oh, Bob paints buildings, like, which is not what you do. You have a whole contract company that paints some of the biggest buildings on the West Coast, and it's awesome. And you manage this incredible company. And sometimes people will say things that's just kind of like a lesser or skewed version of you. And you don't even care. Like, you don't even, it doesn't trigger you. It doesn't, like, oh, Bob's a painter. Yeah. And it's like, no, Bob's a successful businessman. He runs one of the top painting companies on the West Coast. Way different. You know, like, but when you have that identity issue, or when you have that, when there's something off inside of you, you're always looking for the approval and the understanding and the connection of what people think about you. And it's just a rat race that you'll never get over.
It is. I'm used to losing, you know, in my business, we lose 90% of the jobs we bid.
That's so wild.
So I'm used to
losing. You're used to rejection.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, my identity has been firmly rooted in Christ. One of the reasons that I don't react when people say you're a painter, or I say I'm a painter, is because I've made so many mistakes, and through God's grace, he's allowed me to, you know, continue moving forward and to learn. And I think as believers, we always have to be willing to make mistakes and fail and learn from them and shift and adjust and realign.
Yeah.
You know, that's what this is about.
I'm remembering when I was in an Asian country with one of the top hotel developers in the world, and for like boutique luxury hotels. And he's a Christian. And we went into a business meeting where he was meeting people for the first time. He invited me. They're all Christians. And he said, I want to really connect with some Christian business people who have success, but also who know who they are in God. And we met all these people, and they would, it was like one at a time, we'd meet them. And you should hear the fanfare. Like, this woman was like introducing, this guy is the most amazing at automobiles, blah, 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 blah. And it was like this big pumped up thing. And then like someone introduced themselves, and this one guy introduced himself. He's like, oh, I just have a small manufacturing company. He shakes his hand. And afterwards, when we were sitting at the dinner table alone and everybody was like about to come, he goes, I want to talk to that guy the most. I was like, the last guy, he seemed the most uninteresting. And he goes, he was the most unassuming, but he was wearing the nicest watch and the nicest shoes of everybody there. And he had like this just presence about him where it's like, he didn't care if we knew what he did or not. That's the one that's the most important here. And I was like, that's so funny. And they ended up becoming friends and doing some business stuff together too. And the guy ended up being like almost the same level of wealth as him, and the whole, and everybody else was like on their way. And it was just funny how wealth recognizing the humility of what he was coming in. And I think there's something about like when you're an imposter or when you're comparing or when you're going through, there's party that you are building your story instead of letting God build your story. You're building your reputation. You're building your credibility. But you can tell when somebody's taking a hit in those areas and let God build it because they don't need the fanfare and they don't need to be big.
Yeah. And I mean, we're looking for those humble people to be around, aren't we?
Yeah. That's why you're around me, Bob.
Yeah. We'll speak to that. Talk to us about our guest coming up.
Well, our guest today is Dr. John G. West. He's the vice president of Discovery Institute in Seattle and co-founder of the Center of Science and Culture. I love those names. I mean, they're so transformative. He's an award-winning author. He's made a dozen documentaries and 13 books to his name. Wow. He's also a former chair of political science and geography department at Seattle Pacific University and holds a PhD in government from Claremont Graduate University. And his new book, it's called The Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. Stockholm Syndrome Christianity exposes how some Christian leaders have aligned more with secular culture than biblical truth, and it equips believers to stand firm. I love this. We're going to hear why he did this, why he went into this, how he became a professor up next.
I want to invite you to partner with us to spread the gospel around the world. And we're doing this through our TV shows and our podcasts, our social media. We're helping Christians navigate culture with a biblical worldview of what God's doing right now in society, news, entertainment, the church, through the Sean Bowles Show, which is our weekly commentary show on podcasts. We're building courage with our ministry audience for their calling and their careers for exploring the marketplace, which is a CBN news show and a podcast. And we're helping thousands to grow spiritually in their connection to Christ and training them to hear God's voice. And we're activating them in their gifts and helping them to have coaching tools for their inner development through Spiritual Growth Academy online. On top of this, I get to minister around the world with Sound Biblical Truth on Prophetic Edge through YouTube all week long. And we have Sunday services even with YouTube. And we have weekly videos. And this doesn't even touch other social media that we do. I, of course, do a lot of ministry with TBN, and I host a lot of different media outside of what we're doing in our ministry. But we want to have you come help us. We want to invite you to help us expand our reach. And we are on testimony overload of the goodness of God, changing people's lives through the impact that we're having as a ministry. But we need you to help us create this media, this ministry. You can be a part of our team and our family. And we get to pray for you when you do this. We pray for our partners weekly. We get to resource you. We send you regular resources, both in the mail, but also online, because we want you to be equipped and reinforced. And we also have monthly partner meetings where you get to connect with me and our Bowles team online live, so you can feel the synergy of what God's doing and let it energize your life, as well as we get to pray for you live every month. And if you can't come live, you're still going to watch the video and get the prayer, because we take whatever God's doing in our ministry and we impart it to you so you can have the benefit. But become a partner today so our fruit becomes your fruit.
Well, welcome back to the show. We're here with John West. John, we're honored to have you.
It's an honor to be with you.
John, you're such a fascinating person because your career has spanned a lot of different things. I mean, documentary filmmaking, of course, being an author, ministry, but also college professor. I'm going to start there at the college professor at a Christian college, because there's been a lot over the last 15 years that I've been focused on as far as sociology around college campuses, both Christian and otherwise. And it's been a kind of a wild place to be, but kind of take us on your journey of why you've chose a career you chose and where did God show up first?
Sure. So God showed up first in sort of opening the door for me to go to a summer program. This is when I was an undergraduate in actually my junior year. And that was actually led by some people who were in graduate school and were actually trying to recruit people to go to graduate school, I later learned. And so it really got me focused on that. I mean, I was the first person in my family to get a doctorate or to go on that way. And so I wasn't really anticipating that, but God opened the door to that. And then sort of through a variety of circumstances felt led that I should try to become a professor. But frankly, that was a really discouraging experience. I could talk about that, the challenges.
Tell us why was that a discouraging process?
So, I'm a pretty theologically traditional Christian, and let's just say that academia isn't the most welcoming environment for theologically conservative Christians. Frankly, it's not the most welcoming environment for men, because there's a push of there are too many men in control of things, and so. It was, I at one point I actually kept my files of rejection letter after rejection letter, dozens of rejection letters, and it was really discouraging. And it was only on really after I had almost given up becoming a college professor that God opened the door for actually the place where I became a professor and gained tenure and became a department chair at Seattle Pacific University, which was a historically Christian university. But even that, they really, my profile didn't fit what they were hoping to get.
Wow.
I wasn't a woman. I was probably more theologically conservative than many of the people there. But so in fact, some more discouragement. I was first hired there. I was up for a full-time permanent position and I ended up being the finalist, but then they decided, oh, well, we're now going to just offer you a one-year position, even though I was the finalist for that, because they still wanted to hire a woman or hire someone else.
Wow.
So that was kind of discouraging. But you stoop to conquer. I think, God calls us to be humble. And I took that. And then out of that, I was able to, I guess, convince them, or God was able to convince them that I wasn't a bad guy. And so then I was able to get the full-time tenure track position and ultimately became a department chair. And ultimately, I think, actually became a good professor. That's also challenging when you're dealing with students. I taught general ed courses that weren't just political science. My background was political science. And so when you're dealing with students who are taking a course because they have to fulfill a requirement, even though they're not interested in it, that's an interesting experience. And so it's a very humbling experience the first time you get your teaching evaluations. But out of that, by the time I left, which was 12 years later, and I voluntarily left, I wasn't pushed out. But when I left, then go on to do what I'm doing now, which is work in the nonprofit world. At a sort of NGO, I had become a good professor and I had learned how to teach well and connect with students. And so that was gratifying, but it was, certainly not smooth. And I do think that there's a lot of truth to being persistent and being humble and crying out to God. and then we can talk a little bit more about some challenges while I was there, because the university was in transition really away from its evangelical heritage. And so as I tried with a few other faculty sort of to stand up sort of for a different direction, that led to some really challenging cases where that I had to work through.
Well, let me ask you a question, John, because it strikes me, you experienced rejection early in your career. And how, looking back on that now, how did that learning to deal with that rejection with God, how did that fuel the balance of your career, knowing that you came from that?
Well, I think it increased my trust in God, because I wasn't angry with God. It was depressing. Why? Yeah. I think you called me to this, and how many dozens of places do I need to apply? And you begin to question yourself and you cry out to God and you realize that he's the only one who actually can intervene on your behalf and that he has a purpose. I strongly believe, I'm sort of more from the background of Protestant Reformed Christianity, it's a big belief in the sovereignty of God. And so that doesn't mean things are going to turn out how we want them to turn out, but it does mean that the future is in God's hands. And so, we need to bow to that, and God will bring good even out of really challenging circumstances. And so I think, looking back on that, in a way, it's hard to dwell in that time period because it was very painful. But seeing how God worked and opened doors when I least expected it. So I think that's, one of the things is that when you hit bottom, you don't know it's bottom at the time. And, but you never should count out the plans that God has for you. And I have to say, looking at all of my life, that probably the greatest opportunities that I've ended up having have not been things that I would say that, well, I was so good or I did this. It's really stuff that I had very little to do with. One of my favorite verses comes from Ephesians 2, where it talks about God, basically, that we're his masterwork, we're his creation, his workmanship, and that he has created us to do good works, to walk into good works that he has created for us beforehand. And I think that I once had the privilege of giving a high school commencement at a Christian high school. And that was the verse that I spoke on, because looking back at my life again, I think that some of the most rewarding things I've done, the most impactful things I've done, they certainly were not my ideas. And it was that doors were opened that I just feel it was prepared beforehand and I walked into it. And my only contribution was being willing to walk into that door that God opened. And so,
it's so funny because when you're saying that, I kind of see us in some ways life as like a pinball machine where you're bumping up against things until you get to the right spot with God. If you have Christianity, you have those bumpers that you eventually get to the right space because God's planned it for you. I mean, it says that right in Ephesians 2. I love that scripture too. And if you don't have Christ, you don't necessarily have that alignment to get you to that space. And I think of like a lot of the colleges that, you know, were the Ivy League schools of the Pacific, or not the Pacific Northwest, but the Northeast, like Yale and Harvard, and where they had great awakenings and reformation. They came from some Christian level Christian root systems, and how secularized they've become. And then you're talking about, you worked at a college that one of the big challenges was it's a Christian college, but it became very maybe non-evangelical in the sense of its Christianity. I'm from LA, and so I mean, I was pastoring a church, and one of the big challenges is that people don't want to be traditional Christians, and they don't want to have traditional Christian values. They want to experiment and explore all the different values. So I know how painful and hard that can be. I know you've worked now in that space of helping people, but talk a little bit more about the college experience and like, what was that like 10 years in when you're still fighting the good fight of going, but wait, guys, we're Christians, right? Right? You know?
When I was hired, finally, one of the panels of faculty that interviewed me warned me that, we have a very theologically conservative board of directors, and they just denied tenure to someone in the theology department because they were sort of, you know, out there progressive theology. And they thought, you know, they were counseling me to that I should be careful. And what they didn't know is in my heart, I was saying, wow, that's great. You actually have a board of trustees that is concerned about the theological integrity of the institution. The sad thing is, so it lets me move ahead 12 years, where one of the last sort of battles that I fought was to defend someone who was being denied tenure, not because he was theologically unorthodox. He, in fact, in the 12 years I was there, I think was one of the absolute best people that we hired, just real heart for evangelism, heart for Christ, heart for excellence, formed connections in the business community. But basically, he was too theologically conservative, too evangelistic for his fellow faculty members. And so they deep-sixed him because of that. And the board sadly rubber-stamped it. So we went from a board of trust. That sort of isn't a picture of what happened at my institution. You had a board that actually was doing what they were called to do. And I know a lot of people who listen here are, you know, business people in the marketplace. You're the type of people who are recruited to be board members of Christian educational institutions.
Absolutely.
And I would urge you, you're often told, as the board members at my institution were told, well, you're not the expert, so just stay out of it. You're just here for helping us to raise funds and helping to be rah, rah, rah. And I'm saying, that is not, if you accept, you know, being a board member at a Christian institution, your number one goal is institutional integrity. It's not raising funds. And so don't be persuaded, because I saw our board members at our institution, I think one of the big problems, one of the warning signs was they were persuaded not to pay attention, not to take an active role. And where things really came to push came to shove was when the president wanted to break the school away from its founding denomination, which was an evangelical Christian denomination. So they helped choose basically a large part of the board members, and then the other board members had to affirm sort of the doctrinal stance of this founding denomination. And the president wanted to junk that. And that really concerned me, because you're exactly right about the Northeast, your place like Harvard, Princeton, Yale. Those started out as evangelical Christian institutions to spread the gospel and to spread a Christian worldview. But by the mid-19th century, they were not doing that. And they fell away. And so evangelical Christians in the late 19th century established a whole new slew of colleges to try to, you know, provide, you know, a good antidote to that. And many of those Christian colleges were faithful for a long time, and there are still some today that are. But what we've seen, I'd say, in the last couple of decades, I saw it at my school and there are other schools, is that same pressure that changed Harvard, Princeton, Dartmouth, Yale has now been exerted on many historically evangelical Christian institutions. And so I had just gotten tenure when the president came up with this plan. They tried to push it without an open discussion. And that, so in, often when bad things happen, it's sort of outside the light of day.
Yeah.
Well, so I had a choice to make, and it was hard, but I ended up sort of speaking up against it, and ended up someone in the founding denomination basically released the secret plan to me. And it turned out that our board itself didn't know about the plan to junk them. And so I was involved in getting this release to the board. And if I hadn't had tenure, I probably would have been fired.
Yeah.
I was called on the carpet. I was in the doghouse. I faced other repercussions, but, and in retrospect, I mean, I think I did the right thing. The tragedy is that when the board found out, even though they didn't really agree with it, they had a failure of nerve. They didn't fire the president. And so what happened is, you know, he withdrew the plan temporarily, and then within the next couple of years, he basically got his way. And so, and that change of the board then led to, say, just a couple of years ago, where over 70% of the faculty at Seattle Pacific University voted in a survey against biblical marriage. And how do you have an evangelical Christian institution when over 70% of the faculty are on record as being against biblical marriage? And I say, at that point, you really don't have an evangelical Christian institution. Yeah.
John, this leads us into your book. And talk to us about what is Stockholm Syndrome Christianity.
Yeah, because so the Stockholm Syndrome, for those people who don't know, there was this bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden, where hostages were held. But then something strange happened. After the multiple days of the hostage, by the end of the hostage crisis, many of the people held hostage began to feel grateful and sympathy and adopt the point of view of the people who held them hostage. And so what I saw when I looked at my fellow faculty members or other people in my current work of Christians who sort of are looking more like the world, you know, who may be personally sincere Christians. So, you know, they believe in Jesus, Jesus is their savior, but somehow their actual worldview ends up looking like the world. And I actually think the Stockholm Syndrome helps explain it, because if you're a Christian who goes into the marketplace, you know, in the business world, in entertainment world, the media, government, you spend a lot of your life either training under people or with a peer group of people who are largely hostile to your Christian faith. I mean, they may not be hostile to you personally, but they're hostile to the underlying worldview. And in that situation, it's quite possible to begin to adopt the mentality, the assumptions of those surrounding, you know, secular elites. And I think that explains a lot of tragic, you know, cases. You know, we want, Christians are called to bring salt and light to the world. And I think a lot of people think if we just had more Christians in the marketplace and government and this, you know, our culture would be a lot saner. There's some truth to that, but here's the caveat. That's only if those Christians actually act as Christians, not just in their private life, not just on Sunday, but in how they act in the professional world, in government, and if their views on things are really identical to the secular elites around them, then, you know, nothing's gonna help. And so, you know, the bottom line for my book is seeing, you know, often as Christians, we complain about, oh, those awful atheists are doing these horrible things, or these agnostics are doing these horrible things. And yeah, I do think there's truth to that. But increasingly, when I look at, there are a lot of people who are personally faithful Christians who are in places of leadership, and they're facilitating some of the same things. And so it's sort of like, Houston, we have a problem. We need to get our own house in order. We need to be intentional about discipleship and equipping people for leadership.
Yeah, I think I was listening to George Barna's latest research from just a few months ago, where he said, if you don't have a biblical worldview, your propensity for mental illness is like one out of every five. You know, it's like he's talking about biblical worldview actually heals people from mental illness issues, and they can prove it now. And I'm like, you see that. And I was a pastor, of course, in LA for about a decade. And I remember the first time, the first year, one of our married couples, I wasn't married at the time as being a senior pastor, is funny, but one of the married couples who was just really established, great theology, taught on just biblical marriage, you know, the sexual identity of biblical marriage, about, you know, waiting till marriage, just that very simple principle. And we had people who were volunteer leaders that, I mean, of course, we're all new volunteer leaders who were like, I've never heard that before. Yeah. Or they've been in LA their whole lives, you know, or they were in the entertainment industry, and they were still around people like, it's not old fashioned, like just a biblical view of marriage and intimacy, isn't it? Like, that's kind of like the 60s, right? That's not now. And so I do think that because no one stood for so long in these places of culture with not being a loud voice, but just being a voice, then people, just our silence has accommodated their viewpoint, and they think that we're with them. And so I loved when I read just some of the themes of your book, because I thought, wow, I do think that, you know, there's a lot of people willing to stand now. There's a lot of people willing to say things, especially kind of post-Trump, and whether you're for Trump or not, Christianity is actually having its day again, in the sense of we're allowed to be loud, we're allowed to have conservative values, that Christian values are oftentimes conservative values. So what do you think as far as a Christian's role right now in the midst of writing this book, when you're in a company and you're in a career like being a doctor, or you're in a career like being a policeman, and you want to practice this value, but you might be held up by the Stockholm syndrome, you know, the Christian version you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good question. And I think that, you know, Christians who are in secular careers, there are two different issues. And one, what I'm focusing on my book is, first of all, we need to be clear about what the truth is, and we need to make sure that with our kids, with our fellow parishioners, and with ourselves, that we're applying in our own lives and that we understand what's right. But now there is a separate question, which I don't deal as much with in my book, but is just equally critical, especially for people, say, if you're in medicine or business or a police officer, or, you know, what you're talking about, is prudentially, what are Christians called to do in given situations? And I do think that that calls for discernment. I'm not one who says, you know, people just burn down the house. I mean, I think you, if you're in a, like say, if you're a police officer, you're not, your job isn't about proselytizing or giving the gospel to the people that you are. I mean, there are conflicts. You can't force. Now, you can act with integrity. It may also be that you develop relationships with people who are open, and then you can openly share voluntarily. But I do think that, I also say that sometimes being silent, if you're in a larger organization where, let's say, not a Christian organization, you're not called to speak out on everything. You have to choose your battles. And so there's a difference. Yeah. So there, prudence is not a bad thing. It's a real thing. But my bottom line is that too many Christians aren't even getting to that point of raising the question of, well, how do we be discerning? What are the issues that we can speak out in this particular context? What are those that we're not? They're already ceding ground by saying, like in the area of sexuality, they're ceding grounds about that sexuality is reserved for marriage, or they're not even in their own lives or their children's lives speaking lovingly truth, and because they're sort of bought off and thinking that it's not all that important, when in fact it does. And so I think once you get the first things right in your own life and in your kids' life and in your fellow church members' life, then you can also begin to think, you know, how can Christians actually stand up in the marketplace? And I do think there are ways to do it. And I think you're exactly right with regard to whatever people think of Trump. Let's just talk about one specific case. A lot of people sacrificed a long time so that we could be able to push back against this horrible transgender cult on kids, you know, where they were doing, you know, surgeries on young girls and young boys of taking off body parts. I mean, this is child abuse. Yet 5 years ago, if you said it, you'd get canceled.
Absolutely.
But partly because Trump and some Christians also were willing to bear the cost of that, they trailblazed. And now we actually have a window where I think Christians, including in the marketplace, can be more more outspoken on that. Yeah. And I do think that, you know, we need to use the freedom we have or else we lose it. So
yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, that's really good. And time went fast. But as we close, you know, I'm going to ask you, like, what is the slippery slope? And when you answer that, how do people get a hold of your book and get a hold of you?
Yeah. So the danger of once you start compromising biblical faith is you first say, well, you know, we're just compromising this, so it's not all that important. Right. But my major point is that if you're taking your cues from the worldviews, sort of the non-Christian worldviews around you, as the culture gets worse and slides down into the gutter, you're going to be pulled right along with it. And so it's not a static thing. And so you might think it's a static thing, but once you start taking your cues from the culture, if the culture goes to heck, you're going to be dragged along with it. And I do share some really poignant cases in my book, Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. So people can find out about that by going to the website for the book, StockholmSyndromeChristianity.com. And there's a lot of free resources on that site, including a series of self-evaluations. If you want to evaluate yourself or your friends or your church or you know, maybe a Christian school you're sending your kids to, you know, about whether they're showing symptoms of Stockholm Syndrome Christianity, you can do that. And you don't have to give any personal information. You just do it and it will give you the results. And so that's something that anyone could do. And there's also a list of resources and things. So people don't even need to get my book. They can just go to the website and get a lot of different resources. Of course, I hope they'll want to read it.
Of course. Well, John West, thank you so much for being on here. Thanks for sharing about just your time as a college professor. I know there's a lot of people who want to make a deep impact in their faith and in education. And even hearing your story and what you had to go through, it's going to, like, I think it's probably providential for someone who's listening right now to say, wait, this is exactly what I need to hear today. And then on top of that, just Stockholm Syndrome for Christians, I think there's something that's happening right now where people are wanting the authentic. And I love books like this because it causes people, the watered down versions of Christianity, to get exposed. And we go after Jesus with authenticity, and we go after the true God of the Bible. And I love that. So I so appreciate your perspective today and just helping us out.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I do think there's a revival of really craving, and I think God of authenticity. And so I think that's a very positive thing that's happening right now.
Yeah. So good. Thank you for being a part of Exploring the Marketplace, where faith and business collide to shape culture. Stay ahead with free resources, online courses, and exclusive content at bowlsministries.com. And even dive deeper with our online training, spiritual growth mentoring community, or grab a copy of Wired to Hear, the book that Bob and I co-authored to help you hear God in your career.
We're building a global conversation. You can be part of it. Partner with us or donate today, or recommend new guests for our show to fuel the impact. Let's stay connected. Follow us on social media at Sean Bowles or at Bob Hassan.
And did you love the episode? Share it with your network and leave a review. It helps us so much to reach more people who are ready to bring the kingdom into the marketplace.
See you next time.